Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents Afghans' View of Afghanistan's History, presented by Professor Robert McChesney, New York University. This is the second lecture in a series entitled A Multidisciplinary Approach to AFPAC Region and Its People, being hosted by the MES at MCU. Dr. McChesney is a professor emeritus of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and History, as well as a director of the Afghanistan Digital Library at New York University, where his area of research is early modern history of Iran and Central Asia. This lecture took place Thursday, 18 February 2010, from 1400 to 1530 at Gray's Research Center, Quantico, Virginia.
Dr. James Cannon brought a very different perspective on the tribes. Is he right? No. Are we right? No. There is nothing right. We have to keep on looking at these to find an answer that brings us closer to our objective without casualties or little casualties on our side and on their side, and the enemy either is also defeated and those who are there fighting because they're fighting not on an ideological basis, but because there's nothing else to do, or they have been misled, that they come into a reconciliation program. So this series looks into these aspects. And I personally believe, and Adam Sykes and I also believe, that knowing certain things about this history of Afghanistan, Pakistan, about the nuances, is crucial in our understanding. And therefore, it is indeed an honor to me, and I say that absolutely clear, to introduce you to somebody who is not only one of the top authorities in the United States, and indeed globally on Afghanistan's history, not only Afghanistan, but beyond Afghanistan, the entire Central Asia. And also for me personally, Professor Robert McChesney is my mentor. Everything those of you who have been to my classes have heard me, anything positive you've seen from me comes from him. Those negative sides are my fault. Professor McChesney's career is very distinguished. I had, as I said, the honor to be his assistant and actually sit in classes with him at New York University. At the time, he was the Dean of Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at NYU. Right now, he is a professor emeritus from New York University. He right now lives in Maine, but he by no means is sitting idle. He is right now doing something which those professors and scholars who are absolutely not idle cannot do. One of the projects he has in hand is translation of Faiz Muhammad Khatib's book. He will talk to you about it. And if you see the size of the book, you know what I'm talking about. And the fact that this book is written in a very old Persian without any punctuation, then will make it even harder how this, he knows more about this history than, and I will say that without any exaggeration, than anybody around, living or dead. So you're having, in my view, subjectivity, you're having maybe the best person to explain to you how the Afghans see their history and put it into context with you. Dr. McChesney has written several books, two of which actually we have in the library upstairs, and he is also the director of a project called the Afghanistan Digital Library. What is Afghanistan Digital Library? It is a web-based library at New York University. You can look at it if you go to nyu.edu, and then I think you can search for Afghanistan Digital Library. The project is to preserve all the historical works published in Afghanistan from 1860s, which was the first one, until the 1930s. And I think he can explain more to you. I think the project is about to be completed. So while in Maine, he remains very active in Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, and the Central Asian Republics, and Iran. And as I say, it's a distinct honor for me to introduce you, Professor McChesney.
Thank you, Amin. I came down to Virginia for the snow, by the way. I was particularly feeling deprived up there in the great north. Thank you again. This is a It's a great privilege to be here today, to be in front of an audience that has a real stake in what is to many of us an academic subject, and I hope I can somehow meet some of your interests. I have really two objectives in the course of this lecture. One is to give you some sense of the very rich tradition of history writing in that space that we today call Afghanistan, to show you how that, secondly, to show you how that history was created and passed on and how it evolved with changing conditions. But I cannot tell you how Afghans view history as an Afghan. And it's only as an outsider looking at what has been written and what's available to Persian and Pashto readers to give you that sense. So that is my one caveat here. To paraphrase the immortal words of Jane Austen, some of you may know these, it is a truth universally acknowledged, and here I butcher them, that a state in the process of formation must be in want of a good myth. It is generally accepted that storytelling or myth is important, if not essential, in establishing a sense of community and common purpose in societies throughout the world and down through time. And we should think of myth not in opposition or contrast to reality or truth, but we should think of it as a kind of true story, in quotations, about the past that gives meaning to the present, so that people look at things happening around them and they can associate it with something that they understand from the past. And that's really what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to be talking about this notion of what constitutes Afghanistan's true story. This is something that has been called by scholars the true story, a master narrative. And I'm going to use that. Oops. Okay. Are we getting a clear? We may have to do something like go to the low-tech thumb or something. Can we move that on? Do I have to turn this on? No, we just lost it. The master narrative is an account of the past that attempts to embrace or account for all the local stories that fall within the domains of this. There we go. Give you a definition. It's really, its role is to illuminate for a people as a whole where they've come from and where they're likely or want to be going. It's a story that is not without problems in its creation. It never is ever actually completed. It's always something in process of being made. And it's in the politics of a nation state, it's full of conflicts. The process of creating a master narrative is full of conflicts over how to control the story that's being told. And that's really what I'm going to be talking about today. In Afghanistan, national boundaries, as you no doubt all know, have forced into proximity many groups with contending narratives. In order to further process the process of nation building, of creating the loyalties on which nationhood is based, Afghans have made efforts over time to develop a true story, a master narrative about the past, about the origin and evolution of the nation, and a rationale for the present, the time in which the story is being retold. This is a story that is supposed to generate feelings of solidarity, commonality, inclusion, rather than isolation and division and conflict. But where groups within a distinct space have different languages and dialects, Afghanistan has at least three major language types and many, many, many dialects, that the problem of creating a coherent master narrative is extremely difficult. And in such cases, it's often a dominant group which forges ahead to create, make its story the one, the master for the others. At the time, the generally agreed upon moment when the country was founded, 1747, history writing is already a very mature discipline. It's not something that has to be learned from anywhere else. It's been going on for half a millennia at least in Persian and is being continued in the region of Afghanistan. But this is a history that most of us who don't read Persian do not know. And even the majority of people who do read Persian don't know it because they have another master narrative of their own. The Iranians have historically looked down on Afghans as kind of boorish country cousins, and have generally ignored the history of Afghanistan. And the Tajiks in the last three generations or so have had such a different trajectory to their history. Although they're Persian readers and Persian speakers, they too have, this has been quite irrelevant to their society. So let me start with this, at a starting point. We could start much earlier, but I'm going to start with my favorite man, historian. There we go. Faiz Muhammad. We're going to work with three. I'm going to work with three men just for the sake of time constraints. The first is Faiz Muhammad, known as Khatib in Afghanistan, and Khatib has become a family name as a result of this, and all it means in Persian and Arabic is writer or secretary or scribe or some such. And he's known as the writer because of his very prodigious output. The second man was a teacher, a rather obscure person, at the Habibiyya Lycée or Medrasa in Kabul, a school founded at the beginning of the 20th century, a man named Sayyid Mohashim, whose one little work of history I'm going to discuss is particularly important. And the last is a very controversial man, Mir Ghulam Muhammad Ghubar, whose early work I'm going to review, but who was a diplomat, a literary figure, a political prisoner for much of his life, and a very strong opponent at a point of the Afghan regime. So, Faiz Muhammad, see if we can get him, there we go. This is a man we know quite a bit about. He was not shy at all about including his own autobiographical information in his writings. At the beginning of the 20th century, he became the official court-appointed historian of Afghanistan, but why he was chosen and how he got away with what he got away with in his history is still a mystery and maybe forever. He was ethnically a Hazara, and those of you who know something about the social makeup of Afghanistan may know that the Hazaras have historically been at the bottom of the social ladder, have been routinely discriminated against for their ethnicity and for their religion. They are, by and large, Twelver Shiites in a predominantly Hanafi Sunni country. But it's wrong to think of them as a single group. At his time, there were many different groups. There are dozens of Hazara, for want of a better word, I'll call them tribes, who had no real common interests with each other, were often at odds with each other, often fighting each other, and his life is typical of this. He was born about 1862 in a village near Karabagh, which is on the road between Ghazni and Kandahar. And like most, as I said, like most Hazaras, he was a Twelver Shiite, very well-educated one. He was brought up with a gun in his hand, like many Afghans, and early on he was a member of a local Hazara militia, was sent to fight other Hazaras who were causing the government trouble. That was in the first record we have of his life was in 1886, in May of 1886. And then in October of 86, when the government faced a major rebellion from the Gilgai, which is a confederation of Pushtun tribes, he was sent with a cavalry force, to fight the Andaris, a major tribe in the Gilgai Confederation. His education was first at his father's hands, typical, and later on he went, and probably in, we don't really know when, but he went to Kandahar to study with Shiite mullahs there, Shiite mujtahids. Kandahar was a famous place for education. From there, he went to Lahore. We picked up a little bit of English. And then in the spring of 1887, he made his way back to Kabul through Peshawar and Jalalabad. In Jalalabad, he happened to arrive at the time the Emir, Abdurrahman, was breaking up winter quarters. Jalalabad used to be, it's only 70 miles east of Kabul, but so much lower that in the wintertime it was like going to Florida. And the Emir would go there, and there were palaces built for them for the winter. And he joined up, he knew a man in the entourage, he joined up with him, he came back to Kabul. And there he was a student for perhaps as long as 5 years with a well-known Sunni teacher. This man happened to be the tutor of two princes, the crown prince and his brother. And the crown prince recommended him in 1893 to the Emir as a superb calligrapher, and could he hire him, and so he was hired and began to work in the court as a scribe. His main job was to work for the crown prince, to write, to copy books for him, to write letters for him. And then in 1895, when his brother was sent to England, I think it may have been the first official Afghan visit to Europe, his brother went and spent a very interesting 6 months in England and France and Italy. His brother wrote letters home. He was asked to copy them and post them in the market where people could read and see how well and how respectfully Afghans were being treated by Europeans. Sometime about 1902, shortly after the Crown Prince, Habibullah, became emir, he commissioned Faiz Muhammad to write a history of Afghanistan. Now this, I believe, and I've looked at other histories, we know, may be the very first work to treat the country as a unit, as a nation, as a country, something whole, as opposed to focusing on individual kings and their lives and their military triumphs and so on. This is the first to really look at this as a special kind of entity and subject. He was he produced an 800-page manuscript and gave it to the Emir Habib. It was called the Gift to Habib, which is the Persian Tuhfat al-Habib. And it was read and rejected. The Emir said, this is too critical of my forebears. I mean, how can we make this available to the public? And so it was, but I'm not going to put you in front of a cannon. I'm not going to have you hanged. Start over, begin again. So sometime 1905 or so, he begins work on the work we have today, which is the Siraj Tawrik. Now you can see there were no computers, so you had to keep your notes all together. And this is a draft of a section of the third volume of his history. He was an incredible writer. Anyway, so he drafts it. This time the Emir had said to him, I don't want to see the whole manuscript. You know, that's too late. I want to see it in pieces. You bring to me about 30 pages at a time. I'm going to read it and approve it, and I'll censor it. I'll make changes which are required, and we'll go from there. And so he came with things like this, each one numbered and individually titled. And the Emir would take a look at them and make little crossouts where he didn't like what was going on. And they were somewhere minor, like this one where he corrects a title for a governor who is, he's not the governor of Shignan and Wakhan, he's just the governor of Shignan. So he crosses out Wakhan. He crossed out Wakhan, he's just the governor of Shignan. And then there were somewhat more substantive ones. This is a section dealing with the first Anglo-Afghan War and the dealings of, I've given you a translation here on the side, the dealings of the Englishman William McNaughton, who was the political officer, trying to find support amongst the Afghan population with a man named Nizam ad-Dawla. And if you read this in context, you think, well, I mean, why, this seems pretty innocent. It's actually more repetitive than in any way controversial, as far as I can tell. And then there were more substantial changes where Faiz Muhammad, who, like many literary people, thought of himself as a poet as well, included large blocks of poetry in his work, and Amir said, psh, psh, you know, red penciled them right out. So we know, let me take this one more. This is the way the final page of one of the fascicles would look. I'm deeply indebted, by the way, to Dr. Tarzi for taking these pictures in 2005. And he should really be credited for the fact that they're all in focus, pretty much. The last page, three people would have to approve. One was here, down in here, a person would look through it for the Arabic, this full of Arabic expressions, and would say everything is fine. Here, someone would say the Persian in here is good as well. And over here, the Emir would sign off on that particular fascicle. And here's one particular passage. It tells you here, Saturday evening, et cetera, et cetera. I read this thing through, and I've approved it. Now, you have to think, this being the case, that very little slipped by the Emir's purview. He's going to get a master narrative out of this. that he's going to be very happy with. But, you know, Faiz Muhammad himself, and here's the final published version, the title page of the first two volumes. Faiz Muhammad didn't completely give in to this. I mean, he had to go through the process. He had to see it done. But when he got to volume three, it looks like he began a kind of stealth campaign of getting material into the published record that could only have been embarrassing to the emir's father. His volume is being written about the emir's father, and he's being particularly careful, and it's a very long part, very substantial parts of this work, deal with the Hazara Wars, Hazara War, Hazara Campaign of 1892-93. Now this was, for those of you who are not familiar with this, was a, what turned out to be a genocidal ethnic cleansing of Hazaras in Afghanistan, particularly height, at its height in 1892-93. Faiz Muhammad, instead of lighting this, he knew it would never, you can't put this on paper and expect Habibullah to ever approve it, refers to these people as wicked, as evil-doing, that they got what they deserved, and so on and so forth. And yet he was very careful to make sure the names of everyone who was killed, who was jailed, who was banished, women and children, who by groups, 44 were taken to Kabul, the men were executed. Suddenly you have what I consider a Holocaust record of the Hazara campaigns. And it's something that most Hazaras today will be well familiar with, that it's there and that it's available to anyone who wishes to know about it. On that grounds alone, the way it comes through, I consider this a kind of way of subverting the master narrative in a fairly clever way. Maybe it's just my reading. Maybe it's completely a hypothesis. But it's hard to believe that he didn't have this particular purpose in mind, himself being a Hazara, but not necessarily feeling until this point that he's writing about the wars a strong sense of identity as Hazara in Afghanistan. He was a particular tribe. He was loyal to that. Whether one begins to feel he's beginning to build a sense of moral outrage. The second reason I think this book is subversive is that the successor to Habibullah, a man named Amanullah Khan, came to the throne in 1919 when Habibullah was assassinated, and first proclaimed Faiz Muhammad his own court historian. But within a couple of years, he had ordered the Siraj-e-Tawarikh, which was still in process of being printed. He ordered the printing stopped, and he ordered all available copies seized and burned. That they weren't was only probably due to kind of bureaucratic incompetence and also the willingness of a number of people who knew this was available to rush to the press and salvage what copies they could. What I want to stress, though, in terms of this issue of a common story being told, is his notion of what comes through in this book, of the notion of what a kind of a country Afghanistan is. For the first time, you have a country which, in the world's view, represents a nation. It has borders. Those borders are put in place between about 1876, 78, and 1900. Mostly during the period he's writing about in that third volume. Now, the outside interpretation of this, and we owe much to British history writing, historians, for our understanding today of Afghan history, too much, in my view, much too much. This was done by agreement between this Russian Tsarists and the British government, British concerned about India, the Russians concerned also about the British in India. And that it was, these joint commissions were more or less determined by British and Russian foreign policy. But if one reads Siraj-e-Tawarikh, there's no question that the Afghans in many ways controlled the issue of where the borders went. And one of the most critical borders, of course, is that border in the east and the south, the so-called Durand Line. And if one gets from this history the very strong sense that the Afghans knew full well what they were doing when that border was drawn, and that they were very happy to see it drawn in the way it was. So, and I know it's an incredibly controversial topic today, but, and I'd be willing to talk about it more later. So, This is one message. The country, there is a country. There is a space that's divine that puts all of its inhabitants into one unit. The second is the role of Islam in society. One of the things that comes through over and over, there's a Quranic verse that is cited frequently through this book, or frequently enough that you suddenly realize that you're hearing it again and again. Obey God, obey the Prophet, and those in command amongst you. It's a verse, chapter 59, chapter 4, verse 59. Obey God, obey the Prophet, and first in command amongst you. Well, God and Muhammad are not easily accessible for resolving, for getting orders, so first in command amongst you is the one you should obey. So you have this obedience issue. That's what's going on in Afghanistan. The country is being, by force, brought under the control of Kabul on the point of obedience. Obedience to God through the first in command amongst you. And that is repeated over and over again. And that has a secondary consequence, the issue of entitlement. Obedience is not a one-way street. The person who is being obeyed has some obligation to those who are obedient. And in part, again, one thing we find in this book over and over again is the issue of stipends, that you obey, a group comes under the nominal rule of the government, it surrenders, submits, offers its allegiance, and it receives a stipend. And issues of stipends and pensions and salaries over and over again come through, and hundreds of these things are awarded, and you wonder how the government actually could afford it. At one point, in fact, the emir decided to create a Mohammedzai. The Mohammedzai were the ruling clan, as they were for about a century, in which every man and woman from the age of 12 on was eligible for a lifetime pension of 300 rupees for a woman and 400 rupees for a man. Soldiers weren't paid that much. And there were hundreds of Mohammedzai men and women who were eligible for this at the time. So there's this two-way street. Obedience, yes, but entitlement. I get something for my obedience. I don't obey you because I'm loyal to the country as a notion, as an idea. I obey you because you pay me. This is very clearly part of the message. So let me move on now to the second of our historians. Sayyid Muhammad Hashim. Amanullah Khan, the man we were just looking at, is generally more famous abroad for his efforts at social reform during his time than for anything else. And there's also the issue of him somehow attempting to reduce Islamists within society, or Islamic people who speak for Islam, reduce their power. But primarily, I think what he was interested in doing was creating a stronger sense of nationalism amongst at least an elite group, that is loyalty to a state and to him as the head of the state. Part of this was carried out by a different form of education a little more secularly oriented, so you have mathematics and history and other subjects besides Islamic disciplines being taught in two particular places, both in Kabul, the War College, which was situated just below the Bala Hisar, and the Habibiya College. The Habibiya College first met here at the government guest house. The government guest house was built sometime in the 1890s, and they met outdoors, and then they met indoors in the wintertime. And early on, Amanullah asked one of the teachers there, Sayyid Muhammad Hashim, to write a book on history which could be taught to the elementary students. Now, there were three grades. These are not elementary school students that age. These are people in their late teens and early 20s. Elementary is the first level of study at Habibiya. He wrote it in a classic kind of question and answer format, and this had to do with the way in which education was conducted. The first question is, what is history? The answer was, history is a discipline in which human conditions and past events are explained.
Question: what benefit is there in studying history? Answer: through history, we understand past conditions and events and recognize good people and the good works they have done. We can emulate them and give ourselves a good reputation. The question and answer format corresponds well with the style of pedagogy, and it's one of the questions of what is Afghanistan? Afghanistan is a watan. What is a watan? The notion of watan, homeland, we have a, I won't translate Homeland Security Agency into watan, but watan is very much this, the idea of a homeland. It was a very popular notion in the Middle East in the late 19th and early 20th century, and wataniya, the Arabic term, was the term used for nationalism throughout the Middle East. Afghanistan was a watan. It was seen now as a nation. But what interests me here more because of the issue of master narrative is not so much how watan is defined, but rather how history plays into this watan. A question: when did the history of our watan begin? Answer: it began before history was written. Therefore, the ancient history of the watan is unknown. But from histories of India and Iran, we know that in olden times, i.e. before the appearance of Islam, in the western part of our watan, that is Herat and Farah, to Kandahar was a dependency of Iran, and the eastern part a dependency of India. This dependency, and this is what I would particularly want to stress, this dependency was only nominal and pertained to city dwellers. In the valleys and mountains, people remained independent. I think from the standpoint of master narrative, the distinction between dependent and subservient city dwellers and independent rural people is particularly significant, and as a theme would be picked up, but obviously existed in people's heads long before this, would be picked up and followed throughout that book and highlighted in the accounts of the first, second, and third Afghan wars. The resistance comes from the country, it comes from the rural people, it comes from the independent streak in Afghan history. But city dwellers weren't necessarily left out of it. They could imagine themselves as originally coming from the country and therefore possessing those same characteristics. A second important theme of this elementary textbook is the absolute centrality of Islam in Afghan society. History really begins with Islam. It didn't exist beforehand. It provides the common thread which binds all people together across tribal, ethnic, and linguistic boundaries. And I think this is what the Taliban in the 1990s were attempting to reassert. Of course, you have to keep in mind that Habibiyah College caters to the elite of Kabul. Very few people, actually, at its height, it was educating 600 people a year, something like that. Outside of Kabul, for the most part, the curriculum was likely to be that of the Islamic madrasa, Arabic language, Quranic studies, etc., Persian literature, hadith, handwriting, mathematics to some extent. History, if taught at all, focuses on the life of the Prophet and the early caliphate. Those would have been the subjects. In Sayyid Muhammad Hashim's book, we also see the first signs of the polarizing tendency of race or ethnicity to be inscribed into the master narrative. We haven't seen this before. We can feel it in Faiz Muhammad's writing about the plight of the Hazaras, but we don't actually see it somehow articulated. The idea of that the people of the mountains and valleys remained independent while those in the cities accepted the dominion of foreigners provided a foundation for more defined thinking about race, history, and politics. In the 1920s, there are lots of things going on in the world. Afghanistan is not isolated from ideas that are current, and origins of languages and peoples, racial groups, and so on are being studied and articulated, enunciated in Europe and elsewhere, and are going to resonate quite strongly in Afghanistan. Finally, there comes a kind of disruption, which I think is important for the master narrative. In January of 1929, a Tajik with a somewhat checkered past starts a coup, organizes a group of friends, and manages a coup which drives the emir of the country out of Kabul and eventually out of Afghanistan. For 9 months, he struggles to extend his authority while resistance develops against him. For the shapers of historical view, this emergence is wholly unexpected and very difficult to explain. The idea that anyone other than a Muhammad Zai and a descendant of a man named Haji Jamal Khan down through Amir Dost Muhammad Khan could be the Sultan, could be the Shah, could be the ruler of the country was to many people unthinkable, not to the Tajiks, of course. This seemed perfectly reasonable. The opposition to him began to focus on, to find a champion who would return the Muhammad Zai to power, and they found it in a man named Muhammad Nadir Khan, in exile, somewhat unwell, and perhaps initially inclined to leave the comforts of Grasse, France, Provence, for Afghan politics. But he returned, he managed to organize armies and to capture and eventually execute this Habibullah, second Habibullah. The moment of his return has a kind of resonance and is important for the master narrative for both Muhammad Zai, Afghans, and for Tajiks. For the Muhammad Zai, it's a rightful restoration, a return to power of that they had every right to hold. And for Tajiks, it was a moment of, it was an opportunity lost, and a moment that created a kind of grievance, which they haven't forgotten. It was followed, besides the execution of the man after having promised him safety for his life, it was followed by a campaign like Sherman's March to Atlanta through the Kudaman and Kuistan north of Kabul, a part of Afghan history that doesn't appear in any book. This left a major, very bad taste in the mouths of Tajiks. In the aftermath of this, I think it may be fair to say that from the Muhammad Zai viewpoint, it was clear that the past needed a certain kind of makeover, not just to bolster the ruling clan, but to bring in other groups to enhance the prestige of all Pashtun tribal groupings and to somehow coalesce forces behind the regime that would keep it in power. In the meantime, in Afghanistan, there were other things happening besides this return to power of the Muhammad Zai. For example, there was archaeology. Archaeology turns out to be particularly important for Afghanistan because it reveals a past which people were sort of vaguely aware of, that before Islam there was this, there was that. But when archaeology came in through the French, who signed an agreement in 1924 for exclusive rights to excavate in the country, all of a sudden, the whole Hellenistic heritage, the Greeks, the Persians, the Kushan, and so on, suddenly begin to emerge, and these materials were brought and placed in, I think the French got some of them, but not very much, most of it was kept in Kabul, and all of a sudden you have a past that exists on this land that people were simply unaware of, and this has a major impact on the thinking about the country and about its past. What was happening, I think, is revealed in the thinking of this issue of master narrative in a little work entitled A Brief History of Afghanistan, which was written by our third, there are restorers of Muhammad Zai entitlement. Not commenting, that's not an editorial comment particularly. A very controversial man, Mir Ghulam Muhammad Gulbar. He's a government official in the 20s. He was a diplomat serving in Paris, and he was the first secretary of the Afghan embassy in Berlin in 1929-30, by the way, or 1930. It's kind of a crucial moment in German history. And he's a very smart man, and things are happening that I think were particularly appealing to him and turned out to be very appealing to the people who shaped the history of Afghanistan. It's ironic and somewhat disjunctive that he becomes eventually one of the most outspoken critics of the Nader regime because somehow in this early work he actually lays a foundation, a kind of ideological base for the role and rule of the Muhammad Zai and the Pashtuns in Afghanistan. He viewed its history in this little work, which is on the right-hand side, the first page of it. He viewed its history as comprising two epochs, the pre-Islamic and the Islamic. This is a very traditional division. and the pre-Islamic period. I won't go into how he divided. It's not so important, except for the fact that the first group, he says, were the Aryans. Arianism, the role of the Aryans, this tribe, this warrior tribe from India that moves up and so on, speaks to the Afghan view of their own history. And he goes into he goes into a considerable amount of detail about the Aryans, I think little of which actually has much textual or archaeological basis. He imagines a past that had not been imagined before, and in a sense he adds a racial origin, racial touch to the master narrative, because the Afghan people now are Aryans. Their origin is with the Aryan people, not all Afghans, however, but the Afghans that he thinks of as Afghans, that is the Pashtun tribes of the East. He saw Afghanistan's past of the nation, that is of the Afghans proper in his view, the Pashtuns, the Aryans, as involved, as comprising a religious community, a linguistic community, and a racial one. Each of these communities is highly exclusionary. The religious community was defined in his statement, by the way, the statement I think appears in the modern constitution, that the official religion of Afghanistan is Islam. That is his idea too. The religion of Islam of Afghanistan is Islam of the Hanafi rite. But other rites are protected. That's the constitutional language. His language was simply that it was Hanafi, Islam of the Hanafis. Linguistic community was predicated on the assertion that, quote, the basic languages in Afghanistan are Kuhistani Persian of the ancient kingdom, and he doesn't define ancient kingdom, and Pashto, and both of these branched from one source, which was Aryani. Racial community was defined as follows. The nation of Afghanistan is Aryan, and its original centers were Balkh in the north and Herat in the west. Gradually, the Aryans spread out into the mountains for agriculture and animal husbandry. This then puts them into Sultan Muhammad Hashim's, the people of the valleys and the mountains, the independent people, and formed up into tribes named after their homelands or their founders. As he defines each of these imagined communities, he causes more and more of the actual residents of the territory of Afghanistan to disappear. His formulation privileges a specific type, really a Persianized Pashtun Sunni Muslim, and by implication attributes this identity to all the land included in Afghanistan. The narratives of any non-privileged groups, Shiis, Turks, Nuristanis, even non-Muslims such as the trading communities of Sikhs and Hindus, were ignored except insofar as their stories intersected with this master narrative. The religious community, as defined by Ghubar, probably applies to the convictions of a majority of the people of this country then and today, but it excludes a very substantial minority of both Twelver Shiites and Sevener, or Ismaili, Shiis, and that may be, who knows, 20, 30, 35% of the population. And linguistic community, Kuhistani Persian and Pashto, ignores the fact of Afghanistan's Turkic groups, the Uzbeks, Kyrgyz, Turkmen, and Kazakhs. Racial community is further refined to dismiss peoples of Turkic and Mongol origin, calling the Hazaras, Uzbek, and Tajiks more or less degenerated Aryans. That is, originally they were Aryans, but somehow they became degenerate, and thereby leaving only the Pashtun tribesmen as those who had preserved their original Aryan purity. Now this, in 1930, this is a great message. I mean, this is something that has resonance in Europe, it has resonance in places like Tibet, and it appealed particularly to the ruling caste that had had to reestablish itself by force against this Tajik interloper. Until he wrote in 1932, the way in which Afghanistan's past was commemorated had followed different trajectories, but with common features. After 1932, the official story, the master narrative, follows a more consistent line. He imagined an Afghanistan that had not been imagined before, a way of imagining, not so different from the theory of ethnogenesis, which was gaining currency at the time in the country's northern neighbor, the Soviet Union, the idea that a people arises on a particular land. So these ideas of his were particularly appealing and somewhat Interesting that he himself never followed this line. He took a, later in his life, or about the same time, began to develop much different views about racial superiority. Anyway, so this had consequences in Afghanistan, and one of the areas in which it had, I think that's my next one, there's a, oh, I'll skip over that, has to do with the city of Balkh, which I find kind of interesting. He called Balkh and Herat the two centers of Arianism, and Balkh is the cradle of Arianism, where Arianism was born. I think generally if there's a group called the Arians, they seem to, they tend to be associated with India, coming from India, but in any event, he saw it as coming from Balkh. In the 1930s, one of the early projects of the newly restored Mohammad Zai regime was to create a new Balkh, a Balkh in which Arianism could be celebrated, and therefore the Pashtun Afghans could be celebrated. They didn't have the money for it, frankly, it happened, but in the process of it, whoops, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. Let me go back. Hit the wrong button. In the process of doing it, they created, you can see faintly here, these concentric circles. A new town was developed. Roads were bulldozed. Little development actually took place, but it changed the whole appearance of Balkh. Balkh itself, the ancient center, is more or less here. There was an inner city. There was a citadel at this point. The outer walls of the older city started here and went out and kind of circle around in about this area and go out and around here in the inner city. And much of the development in the 16th and 17th and 18th centuries took place roughly in here. So in the process of creating this new city centered here, a lot of old stuff was destroyed in the interests of this new town, which was going to celebrate Arianism and Aryan culture. So there's a, and with it, it brought a moment in the north, which is little known, of a kind of, I don't know what credit to put on it, a kind of ethnic cleansing of Persian influences, or attempted ethnic cleansing, or cleansing. A man named Muhammad Gul Khan Mohmand was sent to the north by Nader Khan to it's not quite clear why he was sent. He was called a kind of minister without portfolio. He was sent to the north in the wake of the Tajik punishment. He was sent to the north, and he's remembered in the north as the second Genghis Khan. Why? I mean, Genghis Khan in the Afghan historical imagination was a destroyer. And I remember one comment to me made by the new minister of culture, in fact, when I was talking to him about Balkh, he said, oh, Genghis Khan destroyed it all. Well, that is a part of the master narrative that Genghis Khan simply destroyed in the 13th century. It doesn't really fit the fact that it was a thriving center in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, but never mind. But this man got the nickname in the north, the second Genghis Khan, and was reputed to have removed from the area Persian speakers and to have encouraged Pashtun tribes to settle in the north. It had been a project for a long time to move Pashtun tribes north into northern Afghanistan, but he apparently did it in such a way that when a Soviet researcher who was there in the 1970s and himself a Tajik was quoted the words of a local 80-year-old resident who said, not one in five Persian-speaking families remain today. Well, this is an exaggeration to make a point, but it nonetheless gives one a sense of some of the consequences of this issue of Aryan supremacy. So I'm going to bring myself to a close here. Afghanistan inherits a rich legacy of different stories of its past. I think this what one would expect of a territory with so many languages and ethnic groups, and more importantly, inhabiting a space which is really open to outside influences. We have the idea that Afghanistan is isolated, but it's not. It's very much a part of a world, and it doesn't have the kinds of barriers that prevent movements of people down through time through it, leaving residue and picking up and so on from it. To forge a nation of any kind from this congeries of voices and narratives, the Afghan state today must contend with the political realities that are the legacy of 19th century nation-making. I don't know how the borders, since borders we have to assume have to be drawn, how the borders could have been drawn in any way that would have eliminated the kinds of problems that are created today, where the Uzbeks, or there are Uzbeks on both sides of the border, there are Tajiks, there are Shiites on both sides of the border, there are Pashtuns, of course, on both sides of borders, and so on. Borders are not helpful, have not been helpful to Afghanistan, but what else is there? To bring about a feeling of some feeling of solidarity, some feeling of everyone being an Afghan, has required an effort over time by the state. Many things are missing. The obvious ones of infrastructure, roads, telecommunications, institution buildings, schools, hospitals, courts, etc. But probably less obvious, but perhaps more important ones are the psychological barriers to national integration and to a shared sense of belonging. And I think these have been strengthened rather than weakened by years of imposing an exclusionary master narrative, particularly after the 1930s, when this is what was taught in schools. And we had an Ariana, I mean, the Ariane thing, I shouldn't make too much of it, but the airline was called Ariana. Students were taught the ancient name of Afghanistan was Ariana. There's that, and the Pashtuns themselves were seen were characterized as a, if not a superior race in those terms, characterized in such a way that you would be left with little doubt. There's a well-known historian of Afghanistan who I haven't talked about, who wrote in English mainly, Muhammad Ali, whose characterizations, it's very interesting to go back and read his works, how he characterizes the Pashtuns. He never talks about the Tajiks, rarely, unless they're linked with Pashtuns and Tajiks. He never talks about Hazaras, Uzbeks, Kyrgyz, and so on, except to list them as members of the country. But to characterize them, they just simply don't exist as part of the idea of what Afghanistan is. He wrote up until he was murdered by burglars in 1972, so it's not an issue today. It's interesting, I think, to add that the Taliban period, that from 1996 to 2001, did encourage, at one level, an inclusive master narrative by dismissing the idea of an Afghan national history and instead embracing the idea of an ummah, of the ummah, of the Muslim community as a whole and the caliphate as the head of the community. And that, I think, we can, you know, in crude terms, can be called Osama bin Laden's program as well. This would resonate very well with the period of Abdurrahman, that he called himself, in fact, he called his throne the throne of the caliphate, and people turned to him as the Qibla, and Kabul was the Kaaba. And so you have all these images of the central importance of the rule of Afghanistan to the worldwide Muslim community, not just the Afghans. So the Taliban were reviving some of this. Of course, they didn't behave the way they exactly in accordance with their message. So, in any event, one's left with hope always for the future of Afghanistan. One understands that the process of integration of gaining of a sense of solidarity, of identity, of loyalty, and so on, is a long and arduous process, and we can see it's been going on now for at least 130 years. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
You want to ask a question?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Will be a little different. It will not be historical. It will be Ambassador Peter Galbraith.
Those of you who have been looking at Afghanistan right now, Stephen Norbert was the deputy special representative of the United Nations to Afghanistan until October last year. He objected to the validity of the elections in Afghanistan, and he was fired by the UN. And Ambassador Norbert will come and talk about what really happened in the elections. Here was much newer. We were trying to mix all that happened within the country. And Ambassador Goldberg has promised that he said it to me that he will still come to me. So you can come and talk, hear what he will talk about. Goldberg's previous assignment, for those interested, he was the person who uncovered Saddam Hussein on a fall campaign of the Iraqi murders in Iraq, and also he was the U.S. ambassador to Croatia, instrumental in getting the agreement between the Croats and the Bosnia. So, that was 25th March. If you want to be in our distribution list, again, please see Adam's site. He will put you on it, and we will hopefully will have you here. Lastly, on this issue, we are hoping Professor McKinsey has also agreed to supply us a paper. Professor Cannon already has given us a paper. We are hoping to publish this as a series immediately after the conclusion of the lectures, which we won't like in August, and we'll let you know about that as well. And since now I'm the chair, could I stop the questioning, please, and bring, you say something about the psychological sense of belonging or not belonging for the non-Pashtuns in Afghanistan, and talking about the alienation of Tajiks and say the, you know, Mohammad Hashim's work. You did allude to the Taliban as, when the Taliban were in control, until 2001, as an inclusiveness based on the Islamic Ummah. Right now, as you know, part of the campaign that we, quote unquote, we, the United States, and our allies, and the Afghan government have, is to have a reconciliation program with the Taliban. In fact, we will have in this very room on 21st March the person who's in charge of that, and the Minister of Land of the United Kingdom, to discuss that matter. In your sense of looking at the Afghan history and the historical narrative we just heard about, a approachment, approaching the Taliban at this point, after what they have done, after what has been caused in Afghanistan because of them, would that not alienate, again, the Tajik, the Uzbeks, and others who have stayed peaceful, would say that, again, the Pashtuns are getting all the attention and the political gifts, even after they do something wrong? Thank you.
That's an impossible question. Yeah. I would say that, judging by history, that yes, they would certainly be unlikely to see this as favorable, except insofar as it might. See, one of the issues about Afghanistan, which is very difficult to articulate in a lecture, is the localism. The fact that the issue of ethnicity we can talk about because it sort of groups people together, but it's not a very effective way to think about things because people act as individuals. And they act on self-interest. And the self-interest may involve money, it may involve a loyalty to somebody, it may involve family, that you do some things which are against your economic self-interest because it involves family or it involves some oath you've made to someone in the past or someone nearby. So it's difficult to say. I think from a political standpoint, the spokespeople for Tajik Party, Hazara Party, are likely not to, unless they see it as leading to enhancement of their roles in the state, are not likely, they'll sit back, I would assume they sit back and say, we'll wait and see what happens, how this turns out. See, the idea of rapprochement with Pashtun groups, again, if you go back to Abdurrahman, he was always making rapprochement to Pashtun groups. Now, some of those Pashtun groups were Muhammad Zai, who'd gone into exile, who had opposed him when he came to power, and they would write letters, you know, please let us come back, please let us come back. And he would, some of them he would let come back, some of them he would not let come back. But it was amazing how often he let them come back and gave them a salary. It wasn't just, you know, okay, you can come back, you make your own way through the world. No, come back, you're a member of a certain group. And it's that idea that others outside that magic circle looking in will say, we're never going to get into that. We're never going to get that
And whether that's also the case today, whether people are able to distribute the resources, allocate the resources reasonably and fairly in such a way that everyone, regardless of their origins, feel, well, it's the best they can do, but they're doing something for me. You know, you don't know. I mean, my suspicion is not. I mean, I think because there is a kind of, we all have, we as Americans have a master narrative that we live with. We don't even, we're probably not mostly aware of it, but it's there and it governs the kinds of things we think and the kinds of things we say and do. If I'm right, and I'm probably not right, but if I'm right about some aspects of this master narrative, then the dominant position of Muhammad Zai, well, Karzai is not Muhammad Zai, but the dominant position of Durrani, right? He is Durrani. Those of you who don't know, I've studied Afghanistan for a long time, to figure this out, and then I'm probably not right anyway. There are two major confederations of Pashtun, Gilgai and Durrani. Is that right? Can we say that safely? And the Gilgai in the 18th century actually ran the country from Kandahar and conquered Iran, conquered Isfahan, and so on. And in their historical memory, if they have a... Am I doing something here? I'm going to shut it off anyway. Just go forward and get it off. If they have a historical memory, it's that, number one, they're fully capable of running the country, and two, the Durranis have kept them shut out for a century or more, for more than a century, century and a half. Since 1747, the Gilgai have been shut out fundamentally of the rewards of running Afghanistan, the perks. So you have that to begin with, and those are all the Pashtuns. So immediately, you know, if you satisfy that group, now what about the Uzbeks, the Hazaras, the Tajiks, the Kyrgyz, Char-i-Mak, the Jamshidis, the, you know, you go down the list of people who aren't in that that group. And to answer, you know, I'm coming roundabout, typical fashion, to answering your question, I would say, number one, it's very difficult to predict anyway. People do funny things that you think are completely opposed to their self-interest. But I would think there would be a certain resentment amongst non-Pashtuns about this. And secondly, you know, if anything, a wait-and-see attitude about how it transpires. There's money going to be exchanged, right? I mean, this is money we're talking about here. We're not talking about ideology exactly, are we? We're talking about money. We're money and power. What will it take to get you into this automobile, right? What will it take to get you back in Afghan government? You know, well, let's see, a lack of Afghanis, or I mean, 100,000 Afghanis, or a new whatever the car of choice is these days, or a new mansion in Kabul. That'll get me back in, and I'll see what I can do about my friends, because that's the traditional, that's the typical way. That has been the typical way. You reward. You get obedience in return for entitlement. So, I mean, I'm overstating this, folks. I tell you, I'm one of the things I've learned is how little I really know. But this is what I feel. This is my emotional response to this. I don't see it. I don't see it going anywhere. I see it's maybe the only thing that can be done because the Taliban are making an impact, but I don't see it going anywhere. He didn't use the word happy. What he does, okay, yeah, I'll finish your question, sorry.
And also, you mentioned that in 1924, his power to evolve or revert, right. He was retained as a historian. Is there a connection? what is the position that he was holding in his history regarding the
Afghan at that time? Right. He was writing in the teens.
1910 onwards, he's writing his third volume, which is the critical volume. And he's writing about something that took place in the 1890s, so something that took place about 25 years earlier, 20 years earlier. What he's doing in the work, and this is why I say he's happy, it may be because he needs to satisfy the emir's reading of his work, but what he's doing is he's placing at the center of the demarcation of that line not the British who are involved with it, but the Afghans who are involved with it. For example, it was divided into four distinct regions. The northeast part up to Wakhan was under Field Marshal Ghulam Haider Khan Charkhi. The next section was under Sardar Shirin Dil Khan, who was the governor of Khost. The next section was under a man named Sardar Gul Muhammad Khan, who was, who was governor of Mokur, Mokur is a town on the Kandahar Ghazni Road. And the next section, which ran what's now the southern border of Afghanistan along Baluchistan, was under a fourth Sardar. And so he, as he writes this, he's saying, and they took the line from here to here to here, and then Mr. Uni, and Richard Uni was the Peshawar commissioner who was on the line with Ghulam Haider Khan Charkhi, objected. You know, he wanted the line to run here, and they give a place name, but, you know, sent a letter back to the emir. The emir said the map shows the line going there that we agreed to in Kabul with Durand in 1893, and therefore that's what it should be. And so they drew the line there. So you always have the arguments over where the line is going, the Afghan side winning the argument, and usually the emir saying, and we're getting all the good land. They're not getting anything. They're getting the Waziris. They're getting the Jajis. We don't want those people anyway. We're getting the good land on our side. So you get the sense as you read this that the emir is happy with the line, and maybe it's, again, a rhetorical justification for, because this is being written down for the emir's son, the emir Abdurrahman is happy with the line. That is the sense that you get. He's not saying we're pulling back, we're going to have nothing more to do with this demarcation. So this is why I say it. Secondly, the question about why the work is censored, he didn't remain official historian after the work was censored. That stopped. He remained, however, a government employee. He worked for the Department of the Ministry of Education and wrote some other books for the textbooks, school books during that time. But he remained a government employee. He did reportedly write a history of Amanullah, which never... We haven't seen the manuscript, so no one really... I mean, people have said they've seen the manuscript, but we don't have any evidence that manuscript exists. So he continued to write. I mean, the man was a compulsive writer, I think, so he had to write. But he wasn't any longer the official historian. The burning is an interesting question. Why? If you remember, in February of 1919, Habibullah is assassinated. There is a slight period. Nasrullah first is proclaimed emir in wherever he was at the time. Was he in Kabul? Amanullah was in Kabul too, but had the army. Whatever. Amanullah comes out of it with the army on his side, and he becomes emir. And then begins something called the Third Afghan War. It had to do, I'm not really good on the Third Afghan War. It's more kind of a series of border skirmishes about... control of the tribes, I think, more than anything else. Anyway, the British bombed Kabul, didn't they? They fly a plane over and drop a bomb on Kabul. Amanullah was an Anglophobe. I don't think there's really much question about that. The Faiz Muhammad's book is not Anglophiliac at all. It's quite hostile to the English. And Amir is constantly saying, you can't trust the British. They're a bunch of devious hypocrites. You know, they'll tell you one thing, they'll do another. It goes right through the book. It's a continual theme. However, there is an incident where Queen Victoria gives, and this is, I've heard this from someone, I don't know whether it's the cause or not, Queen Victoria gives Abdurrahman the Star of India,
Award. Now, the Star of India Award was, I think, a completely made-up medal. I don't think that anyone else ever got a Star of India Award made up for Abdurrahman. He liked medals. He liked show, right? He liked battle ribbons, and he had a big chest, you know, like Brezhnev, and so you could fill it with medals. The letter from Queen Victoria granting Abdurrahman the Star of India was so patronizing that she recognized him as a loyal vassal of the Queen, and she looked on him as she looked on the Rajas and so on of India. It's extremely, for someone who feels Afghanistan is an independent country, the king is certainly the equal of Queen Victoria. What right does she have to do this? And it's all laid out. Her message is completely translated into the Siraj al-Tawarikh. And you have a feeling that particular incident would have offended him. But it may have been that the issue of the border and the fact that the border is so clearly laid out and it looks like it's all settled and so on may also have been a problem for Amanullah. And then again, it may have just been simple personality conflict. You never know in these things what it actually was. People are always looking for what was the reason he ordered that book stopped. It stops, let me tell you where it stops. It's a long, the history itself is about 1 million words, 3 volumes. The first 2 volumes are quite short relative to the third volume. They're about 378 pages. They're about a third of the total 300,000 words, and the rest is 700,000 words are devoted to 16 years of Abdurrahman's reign. The last 5 years of his reign don't appear because that was where the book was censored. That's where the presses stopped, right, at 5 years before his reign stopped. It was supposed to cover his third volume, was supposed to cover his whole reign. He wrote it. The manuscript exists of that part, but it's in the National Archives in Kabul. But exactly why the censorship took place, why the burning was ordered, no one really knows. Maybe we'll never really know. But there are some educated guesses, and one of them has to do with that Star of India Award. Let me answer your first question first, and to say I don't know the origin of why the land of Khorasan, Afghanistan, was called at some point the land of Khorasan. And I think that came after the Ariana, or maybe coincides with it, and may have to do with the fact that Afghanistan had, long before the Muhammadzai came along, of course, was the center of several empires, or the edges, or the parts of several major empires. Khorasan is, probably most of you know, has been the historic name for what's now Eastern Iran and kind of Western Afghanistan was included. Khorasan, if the Arab geographers would include in Khorasan all the way up to Balkh and back to on the west, well, Nishapur and cities in Iran today. So that broad area was known as Khorasan. It tended not to be the Kandahar-Kabul axis, would not be Khorasan. And I'm not quite sure. I mean, you know, if you, off the top of my head, I'd say it's a kind of Persianate interpretation to kind of encompass this literary realm that Afghanistan is part of. So I don't know. I'd be interested to know what you think. I know the term was used, and that was another kind of school kids' question. What was the ancient name of Afghanistan? It was Khorasan. That was an answer. The second part of your question, which actually had, I think, it's several questions in it, but this issue of archaeology is really, I mean, archaeology and ethnogenesis. Ethnogenesis was a theory developed kind of as a political theory in the Soviet Union to explain, to give a sense of nationhood to all these peoples that were now included within the Soviet Union, Uzbeks, Kalmucks, you know, name it, Lezgins, everybody. I mean, all the Yakuts. That the idea being that every territory with people on it now, those people sprang from that territory. That people who came in and invaded that land were acculturated by the people who were there originally. So you have this thing called the Afghan. Now, anybody who's in Afghanistan is an Afghan by ethnogenesis. Well, so what is the, where does that begin? That begins with the first civilized, a group that has culture, not, let's say, Stone Age peoples, but people who have a name, people who have left some kind of artifact of, you know, of beauty. And so that becomes the beginning of the history of Afghanistan, but that kind of collides with political reality, because you don't have any of these people left. There are no groups that can say, our heritage goes back to the Scyths, or our heritage goes back to, well, you do actually have a group that claims its heritage goes back to Alexander the Great, right, in Nuristan, Nuristan. But otherwise, the political reality and so on doesn't really, I mean, we can, here in America, you can say, There were native peoples who lived here. Europeans came, eventually displaced them. They brought slaves. Then the country became a place for people from all over came to immigrate, and eventually you have this amalgam of people called Americans. You don't have that beginning moment in Afghanistan, because every time an archaeological dig takes place, there's something else that shows you maybe another culture was here at that time. So this is of interest for the cultural heritage to say these people were on the land of Afghanistan, but to say that they were that they can be part of conflicts going on today because they represent, you know, the people of Ekhanom who live there are one group, and the people of where Lashkargah or something were another group. I just don't see it's so remote and so untethered to the political present that it lacks sort of relevancy. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. And I'm not sure that answers your question. But if you want to follow that up with something, please feel free. I can hear you without the microphone. It's not fine. Right.
Similar to the same thing happened in Europe during the Amorian period and the Abbasid revolution. that was my interest on trying to find an answer to that. That part of the influence that had that historical perspective, that's where my first question comes from. My second question is really the issue of to create that Afghan identity. Is part of that identity is a very rich identity. It's a multicultural, if you cannot have Pashto superior over anybody else.
Right.
Then you educate the citizenry of those people that this is the culture of this time, accepted all this multi-history, it would move you forward. That's how, from an IO perspective, that's how I look at it. So.
Well, it is very difficult to argue against the idea that if you had a coherent, and you had a universal system of education, and you had a coherent curriculum. I mean, think of the, in Texas and in Kansas, the boards of education decide what will be taught in the schools. So, even here we have conflicts, and serious conflicts, over this issue of what our culture is. Assuming that was the case, then, and assuming there weren't political benefits to be gained by one interpretation or another, and then presumably you could. I don't think people have a problem with the idea that this is a rich cultural, that there's a rich cultural heritage or civilizational heritage in material culture. People don't know much about the politics or the social structures of the Scythians they have to judge it from women's jewelry, what people. How they behaved with each other. I don't, it's the issue of remoteness and the issue of political benefit to be gained by supporting one particular agenda over another. And the process of the narrative, the process of establishing a past is never ending. I mean, this country has this, here I was standing in this, at the center of the, one of the greatest world conflicts that ever, how many hundreds of thousands of people died here only 100 years ago fighting over the issue of culture and what the proper history of this country was going to be about. I assume that an outsider viewing the United States from the period of 1830 to 1900 would say that's not a very stable society you've got there, with at least one major conflict and lots of other minor conflicts taking place in the meantime. So I don't know how to answer in any kind of a very convincing way the issue about whether there's a reflection today. Except to say that there is a struggle. I mean, people are constantly struggling for allocation of resources. The resources are limited, therefore the struggle gets a little more intense, and that the aspect of how you interpret the past plays into this as well. So.
For further information, please contact Dr. Amin Tarzi, Director of Middle East Studies at tarzia@grc.usmcu.edu or Adam C. Seitz, Senior Research Associate, Middle East Studies at seitzac@grc.usmcu.edu.